Well, brothers and sisters and young people, this is a what they call an off-the-cuff session, so I haven't got any prepared notes for this. We thought we'd just have a look briefly at the story of the beasts of Revelation. This is necessarily a very brief overview. All I'm really wanting to suggest is to demonstrate the connection that exists between the beasts of Revelation and the book of Daniel as a necessary key for their proper interpretation, to show that that is a thoroughly scriptural approach to the matter of the beasts of Revelation, whereby we use scripture to identify other matters in scripture. We might actually start with Daniel chapter 2. If you turn back to Daniel chapter 2, most of us know the story of Daniel 2, having heard one or two lectures on the subject, but let's just run through again to make sure that we're clear on the basic details. So in Daniel chapter 2 we have the story of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Most of the image presents no problems with regard to its correct and proper interpretation. So we're told in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 38, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all, thou art this head of gold. So we know quite clearly that Babylon was the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar being, of course, the king of the Babylonish Empire of the day. And then we're told in verse 39, after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. The kingdom that was inferior that arose after the kingdom of Babylon was, of course, the Medo-Persian Empire. And you'll notice that, interestingly enough, the Medo-Persian Empire answers to the two arms of silver, the chest and arms of silver. It was the Medo-Persian Empire. So there was a dual aspect of rulership answering to the two arms of the image. Then we're told in verse 39, another kingdom of brass which shall bear rule over all the earth. And we believe, of course, that this is a reference to the Alexandrine dominion of Alexander the Great and the brazen-coated Greeks that fought with him and that extended their rule over a very substantial area of land. And then in verse 40, of course, we're told that the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things. And so we understand, of course, that Rome answers to the fourth kingdom of iron, and in turn answers to the two legs of the image, which represent the fact that in AD 396, the Roman Empire was divided, of course, into two, into the Eastern and Roman legs. The Eastern Roman Empire based in Constantinople, and the Western part of the Empire remaining, of course, in Rome. Now you'll notice that what then happens in verse 43, as we come to the latter stage of the image, whereas thou sawest iron mixed with clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So the last stage, the feet stage, is described as iron mixed with clay. So whatever we identify as representing the iron dominion, we have to account for the fact that in the latter stages of the empire, the iron dominion is still to be seen. There is iron in the feet, answering to the Roman part of the image. Just a question. We're told in this story that the Babylonish Empire, which was the head of gold, would be followed by the Medo-Persians. The Babylonish Empire only lasted for 70 years. The Medo-Persian, anyone know how long the Medo-Persian Empire lasted for? 208 years. So it lasted for about three times the length of the Babylonian Empire, and yet it's described as being silver, that is, inferior. When we come to the empire of the Greeks, we're told that it's a further inferior status empire, because we've now gone from silver down to brass, and yet the territory over which Alexander ruled was absolutely far more extensive than either of the two empires which had gone before him.
When we come to the Roman Empire, we have far and away the strongest set of administrative controls of any world empire that's ever existed. Much of the administration systems that relate to the Roman Empire have come through to today. Much of the roads have come through today from the Roman Empire, from the Roman system of things. And yet somehow it's described as being inferior. Now the question is, why was each successive kingdom inferior? They lasted longer, they covered more territory, their administrative systems improved. In what way did the successive empires of Daniel 2 become inferior? Any thoughts on that?
The authority of the monarch.
Yes, I believe that that's right. That's the logical explanation, isn't it? They weren't inferior with regard to duration, with regard to extent, with regard to administration skills. The one thing where clearly we could say that each successive empire was inferior to the empire which preceded it was in the matter of the system of rulership that was employed. So, for example, the head of the Babylonian Empire was an autocrat. His word was law, in the words of the Bible. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive. He was an absolute god to his people. When we come to the lords of the Medes and Persians, you'll know that in the book of Daniel itself, we're told that the king's counsellors and princes actually trapped the king himself. They got him to make a law, didn't they? And then they said, well, Daniel's broken the law, and so therefore you're going to have to deal with Daniel, and even you, king, can't change that law. That wouldn't have happened in the days of the Babylonians. The Babylonian autocrats simply would have said, away with them, take their heads off. I'll change any law that suits me. The Medes and Persians were bound by laws that even the king couldn't overturn. So there had been a diminution of his authority as a ruler. When we come to the empire of Alexander the Great and of the Grecians, brilliant military general though he was, he always conferred with his other generals. In fact, we know that at the breakup of the empire, he had four generals that he conferred with regard to all of his planning and all of his campaigning. So Alexander, his power was largely decentralized out into a troika. Well, it wasn't a troika. What's the word for four? A foursome that consulted with him. When we come to the Roman Empire, we have a Caesar who truly is Caesar of all the world, but he's subject to a Senate in Rome. His moves can be outvoted by the Senate. He's subject to all sorts of political pressures that the autocrat of Babylon never ever faced. So there has been a definite decline with regard to the status of the system of rulership that was found present in each empire. And what's the last stage? The feet stage, verse 43. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, actually you can see the parallel in the Hebrew here, read it carefully. Whereas thou sawest iron mixed with clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So the iron becomes the they, and the clay becomes the seed of men. By the way, you'll notice that in that particular verse, the iron does the mixing work. So the iron element is going to be active at the time of the end and helping to bind things together. The clay represents the seed of men. There are three words in the Hebrew for man: Odam, Ish, Enosh. Odam, the man of the earth, from the word meaning to be red, as in soil. Ish, mighty man. Enosh, weak, sickly, mortal man. Which Hebrew word do you think is used here in the phrase the seed of men? Enosh it is. The seed of men is a phrase representing the common, ordinary man who now has a position of rulership. Whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. So the last stage, the feet stage of the empire, of the image rather of Daniel chapter 2, is characterized by a principle of rulership whereby the seed of men come to power. Do you know what we call that? Democracy. The common people having a say. The people power. Let the people have a chance. Let everybody have a turn. Why can't everybody have a say? We hear this in ecclesia sometimes. Why can't everyone have a turn? What right have the AB's got to make a decision like that? Why can't we all have a say in this? That's actually a very evil principle. That's not a Bible principle at all. Brother Robert says in the Ecclesial Guide, talking about the system of elections that we have, he says it's a concession to the evil of democracy. We live in a world so imbued with the spirit of democracy, we actually think it's right. It's not. It's never, ever been God's spirit. He describes it as an unclean croaking sound coming out of a frog. So the last stage of the Roman system, the last stage of the empire system of things, is that principle of rulership now, whereby the common man has a say in everything. And you know what democracy's like. Works in my country. Well, in New Zealand we have a 3-year system of government. So the first year, the year of election, there's all sorts of goodies being handed out by parties in order to get elected, followed by a year of austerity, whilst they try and clamp down on runaway inflation and all sorts of other economic problems, and then a year of easing things off, and then a third year of handing out goodies again, because it's election time again. And they know that if they bring in ideas that are unpopular, they'll be thrown out, because the seed of men really hold the power, the democracy of the common people. That's the worst form of government. And so that's what happens with this empire. The successive stages become governed by an increasingly inferior principle of rulership, until in the end, we live in a world today where everybody has a say. So that's Daniel chapter 2, isn't it? Now when we come to Daniel chapter 7, we have, of course, the ideas of Daniel chapter 2 expanded now into a set of animals or beasts. So in Daniel chapter 7, we move from the image of a man, a warrior, a large man in Nebuchadnezzar's image, to a set of wild beasts. 4 great beasts, diverse one from the other. Any thoughts on why we change from the image of a great man to wild beasts from Daniel 2 to Daniel 7? Yes, I think that's right. Nebuchadnezzar dreamed his dream, and in his dream, this is what the kingdom of men looked like, a mighty warrior. But Daniel 7 is the story of the kingdom of men from God's point of view, and as far as God's concerned, they're all brute beasts, wild beasts of the earth, striving upon the earth. That's God's estimate of the kingdom of men. So we know what happens here. The Babylonish kingdom answers to the lion of Daniel chapter 7. And so verse 4 says, "The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked. It was lifted up from the earth, made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it." The lion empire, and by the way, of course, you'll know that a number of archaeologists in the region of Assyria, Austin Layard being perhaps one of the more famous, has discovered many such winged lions as a symbol of the Assyrian empire of the day. We're told in verse 5 that the empire of the lion gave way to the empire of the bear, which answers, of course, to the Medo-Persian Empire, raised up on one side. Why was it raised up on one side in verse 5? Because, although it was the Medo-Persian Empire, how long did Darius the Mede reign for? Answer, 2 years, followed by 206 years of Persian reign. So I would say it was probably raised up on one side. There was definitely a lopsided nature of this dual empire, though it was actually 2 years of Median rule followed by 206 years of Persian rule. So the emphasis was very much on one side. So the bear is lifted up on one side, raised up one dominion, and that dominion was the Persian, which really was the more influential of the two throughout the extent of the empire of the bear. Then in verse 6, of course, we come down to the empire of the leopard, answering to Alexander's dominion in the Grecian empire. On the back of it, 4 wings of a fowl. The beast had also 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. So what are the 4 heads answer to as far as the leopard empire was concerned? The 4 generals of Alexander, who in fact did inherit the empire on the death of Alexander, didn't they? Now, for 10 marks, give me the names of the 4 generals. Anybody know? Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, Lysimachus. Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. 8.5 marks. That's right, so the 4 generals were Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus and Cassander, and of course much of what goes on in a couple of later chapters of Daniel focus very much on the activities of Ptolemy, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, because they tended to war across the area of Palestine, which of course is the area God's eye is always upon. And then we come to the seventh verse, and we're told, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth that devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue of the feet of it. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So, of course, we believe that the fourth beast answers to the fourth image of Daniel chapter 2, and so we have, as it were, the Roman beast here mentioned with its great iron teeth, answering to the iron element of the legs. Now, the interesting thing about Daniel chapter 7, I'd like you to take particular note of what Daniel 7 says. Daniel 7 says that there was a lion, followed by a bear, followed by a leopard, followed by the fourth beast with iron teeth. How long does the fourth beast with iron teeth last for in Daniel chapter 7? And the answer is, verse 22, until the Ancient of Days come, and the judgment is given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. So the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 not only succeeds the leopard empire of Alexander, but thereafter is in existence from that time forth until Christ comes, the judgment occurs, and the saints inherit the kingdom. Daniel 7, verse 22. That's very important. There's no other beasts, is there, in Daniel 7? Just the fourth one, which then extends down through time until the Lord himself comes. Now that's the key to the beasts of Revelation. There is only four beasts in Daniel, and the last one exists right through history until Christ comes and the kingdom is established. There's no other beasts. Now, when we come to the book of Revelation, we start with Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 1. As soon as we come to Revelation chapter 1, we somehow feel that we're very much in the territory, as it were, of the book of Daniel, and in fact of the book of Daniel chapter 7 in particular. In the book of Revelation, in the very first chapter, notice how the book starts. Actually, I'll tell you what might be a good idea here. If you just hold your hand in Revelation chapter 1 and go back to Daniel chapter 7 and have Daniel chapter 7 open with the other hand, so that we can just do two or three different sort of flickovers and just keep between those two books. So Revelation 1 in the one hand and Daniel 7 in the other. So Revelation says, let's start from verse 4, just omitting the prologue. John to the seven ecclesias which are in Asia. Grace be unto you and peace from him which is and which was and which is to come, and from the seven spirits which are before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness and the first begotten of the dead and the prince of the kings of the earth, unto him that loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood, and hath made us kings and priests unto God and his Father, to him be glory and dominion for ever and ever. Do you know where that comes from? To him be glory and dominion for ever and ever. Hold Revelation 1, go back to Daniel 7, verse 14. And there was given him dominion and glory, later on in the verse, for an everlasting dominion. That's where that phrase comes from in Revelation chapter 1. Dominion and glory for an everlasting period of time. There was given him. Given him, says Daniel 7. Revelation 1 verse 6 says, to him be glory and dominion for ever and ever. Amen. That's straight out of Daniel 7 verse 14. So the moment we come into the book of Revelation chapter 1, we immediately are given an allusion to Daniel chapter 7 to tell us that we're now at the time when the terms of Daniel chapter 7 are going to be outworked. Right? Revelation chapter 1 verse 7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him. Now back to Daniel 7.
That's verse 13, isn't it? I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. Revelation 1 verse 6, verse 7 says, behold, he cometh with clouds. That's Daniel chapter 7 verse 13. In verse 13 of Revelation 1 it says, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man. Back to Daniel. Daniel 7 verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came. So Revelation chapter 1 verse 13, one like the Son of Man, is actually taken from Daniel 7 verse 13, one like the Son of Man. Revelation chapter 1 verse 14, his head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, white like wool. Back to Daniel. Daniel 7 verse 9, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. Now you can't help but feel, just by carefully examining the very terms, the language of Revelation chapter 1, that we're being told that we're now entering into a book which is saturated with the spirit of the book of Daniel, and in particular Daniel chapter 7. This is the opening chapter of the book of Revelation. We haven't even got to the beasts of Revelation yet. The moment we open Revelation, that's what we're faced with. Now it's quite interesting really, because just stop and think about the appropriateness of what happens. Who was the vision of the beasts given to in Daniel chapter 7? Well, it was given to Daniel himself. At what stage in that story does Daniel himself live? Well, he lives at the time of the first beast, doesn't he? The Babylonish beast. So here we start from the time of Daniel, and unto Daniel is revealed the flow of history from his time forth. So we go from the lion, to the bear, to the leopard, to the fourth beast. Now along comes John in the days of the book of Revelation. And when does John live? He lives at the time that the fourth beast has now emerged. So we don't need to go back over all this stuff. This has all been already revealed to Daniel. That's already occurred. We're now at the time of the fourth beast, and now the story of the fourth beast down through time is going to be unfolded to John. That's what the book of Revelation is all about. And lest we should mistake that that's the point, Revelation chapter 1 is stamped with Daniel 7 all over it. So then we come to the beasts of to the beasts of Revelation, and we start to actually examine what the beasts of Revelation are all about. And the more we examine the beasts of Revelation, the more we find that they have to be seen as, in fact, the same beast as the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. Let's start in Daniel 7 and verse 7. So Daniel, we're going to do a bit of flicking around here, but it's worth it, I think, just to establish the point. So Daniel 7, verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, had great iron teeth that devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So one of the things we're told about the beast of Daniel chapter 7 is that it's distinguished particularly by 10 horns of power upon its head. Now we come to the beasts of Revelation. We come to Revelation chapter 12 and verse 13. Not verse 13, verse 3. Revelation 12, verse 3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon. So we don't know who the dragon is yet, we're not told. But what we do know about the dragon is that he's got 7 heads, and he's also got 10 horns. 10 horns. Now that's the characteristic of the Roman beast of Daniel 7, isn't it? Same number of horns. Not 12, not 8, not 6, 10. Turn over the page to Revelation 13, verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So the beast of Revelation 12 has got 10 horns. The beast of Revelation 13 has got 10 horns. Revelation chapter 17, we've got another beast in Revelation 17. Revelation 17 verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So one of the distinguishing marks of the Roman beast of Daniel 7, its 10 horns, the same 10 horns are to be found upon the beasts of Revelation. No particular proof of anything just by itself, but it's certainly a clue that there's something similar going on here. Come back to Daniel chapter 7, and this time to verse 25. Daniel 7, verse 25. Now it says concerning the fourth beast and the horn on the fourth beast, verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. So he shall speak great words against the Most High. So Daniel 7 verse 25 tells us that one of the characteristics of the fourth beast system is that it is noted for its blasphemy against God. Right, back to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13 verse 6. And he opened his mouth, this is one of the beasts, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. So the beast of Revelation 13, or one of the beasts, because there's actually four different beasts in Revelation 13, one of the beasts of Revelation 13 is particularly noted for its spirit of blasphemy against God. Revelation chapter 17 says, in the third verse, it says, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet coloured beast full of names of blasphemy. So the principle of blasphemy against God, which was a characteristic of the Roman beast of Daniel chapter 7, is now seen to be also found in the beasts of Revelation. Back to Daniel chapter 7, where we're told in the 21st verse, Daniel 7 verse 21, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. I want you to particularly remember that phrase. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. So Daniel 7 verse 21 says that one of the characteristics of the beast, the fourth beast of Daniel, is that it has a history of persecuting the saints. Been noted for doing that down through time. Revelation chapter 12 says concerning the beasts of Revelation. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 13 says, and when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man child. So the dragon was known as a persecuting power. What about the beast of Revelation chapter 13? This is even more specific, verse 7, and it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but that's almost an identical quotation from Daniel. Daniel said, verse 21, the same horde made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Revelation 13, verse 7 says, it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. That's virtually totally out of, the very words are out of Daniel 7, verse 21. Revelation 13 verse 15 speaks about another beast, the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So it persecuted those that would not conform to its own ways. And finally, when we come to the beast of Revelation chapter 17, we're told, and the woman that rides upon the beast of Revelation 17, we're told in verse 6, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. The woman riding on the scarlet coloured beast. So Daniel 7 verse 21 says that one of the distinguishing marks of the Roman beast is that it has a history of persecuting the saints of God. So do the beasts of Revelation. how long does it persecute for? Daniel chapter 7, and back to verse 25 again. Daniel 7 verse 25 says, "He shall speak great words against the Most High, shall wear out the saints of the Most High, shall think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand." So there's the saints, given into the persecuting power of the Roman beast. "They shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of a time," or as it's expressed in the, as that same phrase is expressed in Daniel chapter 12, it's described there as a time, times and half a time. And we believe, of course, that a Jewish time was 360 days. One time, two times, and half a time is 1260 days. And on a day for a year basis, we believe that Daniel 7 verse 25 is teaching that the Roman beast has power to persecute the saints. They are given into his hand for a period of 1260 day years. What about the beast of Revelation? Well, when we come to the beast of Revelation chapter 13, we're told in Revelation 13, how long would this beast persecute for? Verse 5 of Revelation 13, "And there was given unto him a mouth speaking blasphemy," great things and blasphemies, "and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. A Jewish month is 30 days, 42 months, 42 times 30 is 1260 days, that's exactly the same time period. So the beast of Revelation persecutes the saints. He's got power to continue for 1260 days. That's exactly the same time as the beast of Daniel chapter 7, the fourth beast of Daniel 7, the Roman beast. We might just look at those 1260 years a bit more in a bit more detail, because of course that's one of the most remarkable ways in which prophecy has been seen to work its way through, and that is in the way in which that 1260 year time period has been shown to be correct according to history in terms of the period of the Roman beast. Now on this side here, Roman beast has power to continue for 1260 years. So on this side here, what we've got is the details of how the Roman beast came to its persecuting power. What happened was, in the year 500, in the years 529 to 533, there was an argument between various bishops all vying for supremacy, and Justinian, who was of course the emperor in Constantinople, declared ultimately the bishop of Rome to be superior to all others. He didn't really believe that, by the way. It was a political move at the time, but it was most important to the development of the papacy, Justinian's decree of that period, which declared the superiority of the Roman bishop. In 549, Pope John received Justinian's decree of Rome's authority, as it was called. A few years later, in 590, Pope Gregory I came to the throne. He would have to be one of the most profoundly important popes that ever sat upon the papal throne, because he greatly increased the glory and prestige of the papacy. It could almost be said that a new era began with Gregory I. And in 608 to 610, Phocas endorsed the decretal of Justinian of earlier days to the Pope of his time, who was Pope Boniface the Third. So what we're saying is there was a period. What sort of period of time does that cover, by the way? If we take it 530 to 610, how many years is that? That's 80 years, isn't it? 80 years of time from 530 to 610. And you can go back and you'll notice I've only put some of the dates down. If you really wanted to study that particular period of history, you'll find some other quite important time periods with regard to the steady increase of the power of the Roman system of things, because we believe that the Roman Catholic Church was always part of the Roman system of things. Always was. How many of you have read Bryce's Holy Roman Empire? Anyone read Bryce's Holy Roman? If you haven't got a copy of it, you really should, because this is an excellent book. What it shows is that the Roman Catholic Church is inseparably related to the Roman Empire. They're one and the same thing. They duplicated each other. Their system of administration, their system of of power, their system of control was identical. And when the empire itself began to diminish, it was the church that actually just simply slipped into the same role and carried on the same. It was the Roman system of things carrying on. They're inseparable. So here we have about an 80-year period during which the power of the papacy, the Roman beast system of that time, and especially the horn on the beast speaking great things and blasphemies and wearing out the saints of the Most High, it's about an 80-year time period as we see the papacy building up in power. And it was given power for 1260 years. And when we come to the end of the 1260 years, we find that that power began to reduce. And so, 1260 years after Justinian's decree, we find that the French Revolution occurred, and as a result of the French Revolution, of course, the influence of the papacy was greatly reduced. Why was that? Why did the French Revolution greatly reduce the power of the papacy? Yes, because there was a reaction against the Catholic Church, wasn't there? Part of what was liberated was a great spirit of hostility to the Church. People became very antagonistic to the Church and to its possessions and to its leaders, and the Roman system of things suffered heavy reversals as a result of what was unleashed in the time of the French Revolution, 1260 years. 1260 years from Pope John's reception of Justinian's decree of Rome's authority, 1260 years later, Napoleon annexed the territorial states of the papacy. They were very important to the papacy. The papacy owned property down through time. During those 1260 years when the papacy had power, it owned vast tracts of property. And those properties brought in substantial revenue. Napoleon took them. And that was a severe blow to the prestige and the might of the Roman beast system of things, the papacy of that time. 1260 years from Pope Gregory assuming the throne, and Pope Pius IX was driven from Rome into exile, exactly 1260 years later, as a mark of the declining power of the papacy. 1260 years after the decree of Phocas, which re-endorsed Justinian's earlier decree, we have the complete end of the temporal power of the papacy in 1868, 1870. What happened in those years? What actually happened in 1868 to 1870? Where's Brother Keith? Garibaldi marched through Italy with his red-shirted men, didn't he? The unification of Italy was completed. The papacy lost all of its temporal dominions. The Pope was confined essentially in the Vatican as a prisoner. And the era of the might and supremacy of the papacy had come to an end. 1260 years later from when it grew in power, from the notable dates of its increase in power. Now you look at that and you've got to say, look, that's what the Bible said would happen. It would be given, this system of things would be given power for 1260 years. That's actually already been worked out in history. Now that's a very, very compelling argument in favour of saying that if that's the case, and we've actually seen the outworking of that in history, then obviously the beasts of Revelation are related to the fourth beast of Daniel. It's not only the same period of time, but we've actually seen that outworked from an historical point of view. So coming back to our little graph here, therefore, it had power to persecute for 1260 years. And when that 1260 years came to an end, we see the inevitable decline of the papacy to the point where it no longer had that power whatsoever. Oh, it was still a church, it was still mightily influential, but it no longer had the ability to rule, to have dominions. Its persecuting power had been taken from it. Back to Daniel chapter 7 again, just for a moment, and to the 22nd verse. In Daniel chapter 7 and verse 22, it says, perhaps we really need to read verse 21 as well. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. So the beast finally is judged by the saints themselves. And that story of judgment is given earlier on in Daniel chapter 7, We're told in verse 11, I beheld till the beast was slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So the beast system of things is finally destroyed by the saints at the time of the end. If you come to the beast of Revelation chapter 17, that of course is exactly what happens to the final stage of the beasts of Revelation. Because in Revelation chapter 7 and verse 17 and verse 14, it says, and this is the scarlet coloured beast, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for the King, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So what happens is, the final stage of the beast is that it makes war with the Lamb and with the saints that are with the Lamb, and the Lamb overcomes the beast. So the beast system of things in Daniel 7 is finally judged by the saints, so's the beast in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 14. And the last point, if you just go back to Daniel chapter 7, I actually just read it before there, in Daniel 7 and verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horns spake. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20 says, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he had deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. So the final end of the beast of Revelation is it's destroyed and its body is given to the burning flame, and the beast of Revelation is cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Now if you look at that series of identifications, you really have to come to the conclusion that the beasts of Revelation have got to be the same story as the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. Has to be, doesn't it? There's too many identifying characteristics that ties them together. And that's exactly what I believe is intended, so that when we come to the beasts of Revelation, what in fact we are looking at, well, let's just have a look at it on a final overhead here, and I don't think I'm going to be able to get all this in one shot, so I might just have to jiggle this around a bit. Can't quite see it all, but never mind. So we start with Daniel's beast of Daniel chapter 7. We move to a red dragon in Revelation 12. It's got the same sort of horns. We move to this beast here in Revelation chapter 13. In fact, the beast of Revelation 13, come and have a look at that just for a moment. This is a very interesting beast. Revelation 13 verse 1. I saw a beast rise up out of the sea. By the way, where does that phrase rise up out of the sea come from? That comes from Daniel chapter 7. Four beasts arose out of the sea. Now verse 2, what does the beast look like? Well, he's like a leopard. His feet's like a bear, his mouth's like a lion. That's the other beasts of Daniel chapter 7, isn't it? So this particular beast of Revelation chapter 13 have got the characteristics of all the other beasts of Daniel chapter 7. You cannot get away from Daniel chapter 7 with regard to these beasts of Revelation. We go from there to what's known as the beast of the earth. From the beast of the earth, we go to the image of the beast at the end of Revelation chapter 13. And from Revelation 13, we go to the scarlet coloured beast of Revelation chapter 17. And what I've said here is the Roman Empire and its central religion, the Roman Catholic Church, in its successive stages of manifestation of time, from the apostles of the first century to our own time with modern Europe under the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. So what are we saying just in summary? We're saying this. Let's just repeat it again so that we're very clear. Daniel 7 sees four beasts. Only four. The last one extends right through time until the saints judge that beast, the saints cast the beast into the burning flame, and the saints take the kingdom. When we come to the book of Revelation, what's happened, of course, is, I'll just take that off for a minute. Remember how I said that, let's just put this on again. So remember what we said.
that when Daniel receives his vision, he's there in history, and he's given the outworking of the beasts down to there. But when John comes on the scene, whereabouts is he in history? He's here, where the fourth beast has now arrived. What John is now going to be given is the details of that fourth beast outworked through time. And what do we have at the end? In Revelation chapter 17, we have a beast that's got 10 horns, we have a beast that persecutes the saints, we have a beast with names of blasphemy, and we have a beast that finally opposes the Lord Jesus Christ and those that are with him, the saints. A war takes place, the saints and the Lord are victorious, the beast is judged, the beast is destroyed, the beast is given to the burning flame. That's the final story of Daniel chapter 7. There is no other beasts, just that one. So what the book of Revelation is talking about, before we, and obviously I haven't got any time to do any more this afternoon, what we're trying to do is broad brush here, aren't we? What we're saying is that what are the beasts of Revelation all about? Well, before we actually look at each one specifically, and look, we could spend a whole session now on each beast, which we won't, by the way, so relax. But what we can say is these have to be successive stages of the Roman beast of Daniel chapter 7. All the identifying characteristics tell us that it's the same beast in its successive stages down until the time of the end when the beast system is finally destroyed. It's all locked room under that system of interpretation. And Daniel 7 gives us the key, by the way. It's not our idea, it's Daniel 7's. There's no room to say the beast represents China, or the dragon represents China, or the scarlet beast represents the Arabs, or the beast of Revelation 13 equals Israel. No, they don't represent anything other than the stages of the fourth beast of Daniel, because there weren't any other beasts. That beast is always there until Christ comes. All we're looking for is different stages of that same beast down through time. That's exactly what we've seen. We've got the historical proof of all of those stages of the beast. They've all existed. They've all actually happened. They've been documented. Its period of supremacy has been measured, marked off, and finished. We're now looking at the final stage of the beast. We're looking at the return of the Lord and the time when the saints will be given a judgment over the beast system, that it might be destroyed and that the saints might, in the words of Daniel, possess the kingdom. The reconstruction of Daniel's image. Oh, I see, right. Oh, I'm pleased you said 5 minutes, because that helps to narrow it down, doesn't it? Well, I suppose there's one simple question we can start with. If we just go back to Daniel 2 for a moment. What part of that beast has never existed? The feet. Anyone like to hazard a comment on that? That's right. So, you see, what we've got here is the last stage, the Roman moving into this divided state of things in the feet, answers to the successive stages of the Roman beast down through time, doesn't it? So in a sense, they've always been there. So what are we expecting to see at the time of the end? We're expecting to see the two feet form. I thought we were doing Daniel chapter 2 and not the beasts. We're expecting to see the two feet form, aren't we? And that answers to the 2 feet of the Roman Empire of old. And so what we expect to see is a power based in Rome. We believe that's already there in the form of the papacy, and that another power needs to take Constantinople, which was the other leg of the empire. And until those 2 feet, if you like, are properly formed in their appointed places, you can't re-erect the image at the time of the end. Now, as a result of that, Brother Thomas says that he believes that Turkey will fall first before Europe is united. Why does Brother Thomas say that? Because until you've got the 2 feet, in other words, the 2 legs of the old Roman system of things, you can't then re-erect the image upon the feet until the feet are actually there. So what we're expecting to see, of course, from that point of view, is, if anything, to see some movement of Russia
into the area of Constantinople, which of course answers to modern Turkey. And when that occurs, the stage is then set for the recreation of Daniel's image. And what will that actually be? Well, what it will be, says Brother Thomas in Elpis Israel, is a reconstruction of the territories of the previous empires. So that when one power arises at the time of the end to recreate the whole image, what we will see is all of the previous empires brought together in one mighty dominion. Now, by the way, you might just go back to Daniel 7 in that regard. For that reason, I personally would believe that Persia will fall by conquest in the reconstruction of the image. Iran, which answers to Persia, was part of the Alexandrine Empire, and in order for it to be taken at the time of the end, it's got to be conquered by Russia, and I think that that's what it means in verse 7. It says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth that devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet thereof. What's the residue that the fourth beast stamps? And I think the answer is, the residue of the previous three empires' territory that it hasn't yet controlled. So the Roman Empire never did control certain parts, for example, of the Grecian Empire. Great though it was, as you will probably know, the Roman Empire tended to move more westerly, didn't it? More into the heart of Europe, whereas Alexander's empire had very much gone the other way, across to Asia. So certain parts of the territories of these three empires all have to be consolidated at the time of the end under the dominion of the fourth beast, and it says it's going to stamp on the residue with the feet thereof. And I believe that Persia or Iran is one of those places, and that therefore when Ezekiel 38 says that Persia is part of the power of Gog at the time of the end, I believe it will be brought under the power of Gog by means of military conquest. It will be stamped on by the feet. Whereas we may see in Europe some degree perhaps of ideological conquest, rather than necessarily an all-out war. We would say that in many respects the stage is being set now for the recreation of an empire which will largely cover the area of these empires, which in the main covered parts of the Mediterranean and parts of the bulk of Europe. And the scene is set there, isn't it? Because what we've got is we've got a spirit now that very much wants to unite Europe together. We've got democracy having moved the Eastern European countries into the same philosophical mould now as the Western European countries. So the principles that would allow both sides of Europe to come together now are very much in place. We've got a dangerously unstable situation in Russia, a very dangerous situation in Russia, where it is highly likely that a dictator could arise at any particular time. There are a lot of fears for Yeltsin's survival. He's riding a tiger, because what's been unleashed in Russia now is the spirit of democracy, and the people now have tasted what power they wield. The seed of men. The seed of men have found out what it's like to be in the positions of rulership. And so Russia is very much right now in a situation where we could easily see a dictator arise. There are many people in the wings. In fact, there are several people in Russia who quite openly say that's what they intend to do right now, including a very virulent general in the army who says that that's exactly what he intends. He wants to re-establish a dictatorship in Russia. And when he does, or if he does, whoever it is, it would be pretty easy to sweep Europe under the banner at the same time. So as far as what happens for the recreation of the image, we expect to see a confederation of all the territories of these empires in one mighty system at the time of the end. It will obviously have a Roman Catholic element, which I do believe answers to the iron at the time of the end. When the Roman Empire fell, there was only one thing left of the Roman system, and that was its religion. That was the principal element of the iron that continued down through time. And as I say, if you can get hold of a book called The Holy Roman Empire by Bryce, you'll find that a most convincing, a most exhaustive, and a most scholarly treatment of research on that particular subject.
Okay. So therefore, Brother Thomas says the order will be establish the 2 feet first and then unify Europe, in other words, recreate the image on the basis of the 2 feet. What's that? Yes, that's right, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, I think the without going into too much detail on the time period, as far as the timing of it goes, you notice that I've been careful here, as I haven't said you'd start the 1260 years from any particular date, because I don't think you can. I think what you have to do is go back into history and say, when do we see the signs of the Roman system, of the papacy particularly growing in power? And as you can see, that was marked over some period of years. It happened over a number of years, about 80 years. Probably longer, for that matter. Who knows? And likewise, therefore, when we come to the termination of the 1260 years, there is no one termination point. It's happening over a period of time as well, that the 1260 years is slowly working out of its cycle down at the other end, and so we see a gradual winding down of the influence of the papacy. Look, I've got no answer on the 42 months of business versus 1260 days, because I haven't looked at it, and so there's no point in me making a comment, because it would only be conjecture. Hands up those that have read Graham Pierce's book, The Revelation, Which View? Okay, well, sorry? The Revelation, Which Interpretation? Yeah. Preterist, Continuous Historic, Futurist. There's a very good chapter in there where Graham Pierce does go into the time periods, and what he says, without going into detail, and I can't remember everything he says now because it's a while since I've read the book, but what he does say is that the reason why time periods are mentioned in different ways, why they're expressed in different ways, is to accord to the decorum of the symbol. So what he says, if you like, is the context of each time a time period is used helps to determine what way it should be expressed. So sometimes it's 42 months, sometimes it's 1260 days, sometimes it's a time and half a times, depending on what the requirements are. But in each case, the period is expressed in such a way that it is suitable for the context. That's what Graham Pierce shows, and I think he gives a pretty convincing argument on that.
Yes.
Is that counting up from Numbers 33, is it?
That's right.
Mm.
So, it may even go back as far as Israel coming out of Egypt, and spiritual Israel coming out of spiritual Egypt into the promised land.
The one slide they had on there, the piece that John saw in the Revelation, are you prepared to put some dates to those things?
No. Well, that answers that one, doesn't it? No, the only thing I would say, and I'm sure that Brother Keith would agree with me on this, is in fact, one of the things you've got to be careful of, one of the very reasons why we can't do that, is because, all right, I'll just make one final comment and then I will sit down, otherwise I'll get trapped here and finding I can't escape. If you come to Revelation chapter 13... One of the reasons why we can't give perhaps exact dates for the beasts, and I don't think that that matters, is Revelation 13 says, verse 2, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard. This is the beast of the sea, isn't it? It's the beast that rises up out of the sea of chapter 13, verse 1. The beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, his feet were as the feet of a bear, his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So was the dragon alive at the same time as the beast of the sea? And the answer is yes. In verse 11 it says, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. and he exercises all the power of the first beast before him. But the word before him, or the phrase before him, Brother Thomas translates as, and I believe this is quite valid from the Greek, by the way, because it's used in many other places in exactly the same way, means literally in the presence of. So Daniel, Revelation 13 verse 12 says that the beast of the earth, verse 11, exercises the power of the first beast. So the beast of the earth exercises all the power of the first beast in the presence of the first beast. So these two beasts are together at the same time of history as well. So it's not as if you have this one and then you neatly rule it off and say, well, look, that's dead and now this one's alive and then that one's dead and this one's alive. It doesn't work like that. In fact, the beasts are concurrent at times. They are contemporaneous at times. They are not sequential. What the scriptures are trying to do here is to outline the development of the Roman system in its various forms across the European continent through time. And at certain stages, more than one of those beasts was actually alive and well at the same time. They are not sequential. They are, in fact, concurrent at certain points of time. And for that reason, it's not easy to give specific dates. That doesn't matter, because that's not the objective of the Revelator anyway. The objective of the Revelator is to trace the story of Daniel's fourth beast down through time until the time when the judgment would sit, the saints would take the beast and destroy it and possess the kingdom. Yes. Oh, absolutely, yes. The unclean spirits came forth at that stage. Yes, yes, the beast has, hasn't it? The beast has changed stance now to accommodate the principles of democracy. That's one of the features of the Roman beast. It's always been highly adaptable, hasn't it, down through time? The Roman beast has always managed to adapt to survive, and it best survives by backing whichever it thinks to be the most successful regime in the earth at the time. Well, that's a good question, and I don't think there is any answer to that. All fleshly systems of government are fraught with problems. Brother Robert certainly says that as far as the Ecclesia is concerned, we resort to the principle of democracy in our elections because we no longer have the benefit of the Spirit to guide us in these matters. We don't have Spirit-gifted elders. But he does say that although we use the principle of democracy, we should do so prayerfully and scripturally. It is not a privilege to be used simply so that everyone can have a say on everything. That's never, ever been God's way down through time. So we need to exercise carefulness and thoughtfulness in how we use that. God describes democracy as an unclean frog-like spirit. If some other way had occurred of history, God would still have found a means of preserving the truth. He didn't need to use democracy to preserve the truth.